This is VSiN's College Football Betting Podcast.
Welcome in another edition of the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Murray. And as always, early on in the week, joined by Adam Burke. You can read his column up on VSiN.com, his updated power ratings, which we will dive into. We'll get into a handful of situational spots. We'll play the game market correction or overreaction. And also, shout out to Mike Palm if he's listening. We might have to look at a little quit watch. We'll throw out a couple teams and whether or not they are ready to pack it in for this season. But Adam, a busy weekend. I know a lot of Auburn fans, none too pleased by the refereeing in Norman earlier this week. And if you took 6.5 with Auburn, that is a pretty crummy way to start your day if you had that bet in your back pocket, as Auburn was probably the right side and ended up losing 24-17. But Mr. Burke, how are you, sir, as we get ready for a loaded week number 5?
I'm good, man. Good to be back with you here. Yeah, if you had Auburn and the Rams this weekend, I don't know, maybe, you know, have you ever been to one of those rage rooms, Tim, where you just go in and like there's a bunch of breakable stuff in there? And they give you like 10 or 15 minutes. So you can just let out all your frustration. I've never done it, but if I was on Auburn and the Rams, I probably would have looked into it.
I had Auburn in the super contest. So that was an unfortunate L. I did have them +7 as a straight bet. So a push there. I don't know how, looking back at the week that was, a 3-3-1 week on the podcast on Thursday, got some late night winners. I think I was fortunate to get Temple to cover. I think I was unfortunate on Miami of Ohio and Northern Illinois. So it was kind of and fortunate on Hawaii. I know not many people were up at 3:30 a.m. Eastern time watching the end of that as Micah Alejado connects for a touchdown in the end zone in the closing seconds. But, you know, what I like to do is to take a step back and, you know, see some of the adjusted lines, which we'll get into here in just a little bit. But I don't know what the biggest takeaway was, but man, I'll just start with this. Kirk Cignetti is a really good coach. And I think we've realized that. I've taken my jabs at him because, you know, he puffed out his chest prior to the Notre Dame game and he looked like a fool punting inside Notre Dame's territory late in that game. But that aside, the dude is now 14-3 ATS as a favorite at Indiana and covering by 17 points per game, and they just hammered Illinois. I know there was some late adding on a little bit, but still, they were a dominant force in that game. And, you know, when you think about the expanded playoff, Adam, we've got to have a real conversation about Indiana making it both years, as now they've got an interesting one this week against Iowa. But, you know, for me, Indiana, very impressive. Fernando Mendoza at a number of sportsbooks, now your betting favorite to win the Heisman Trophy. Sorry, I gave him two extra covers. 12-3 ATS as a favorite, covering by 17 points per game. But Indiana, man, very, very impressive what we saw from them against Illinois in a big-time spot, and they delivered.
Yeah, and I mean, look, they got three real – actually, you know what? I'm going to say they got four interesting road games ahead, because Maryland actually looks pretty decent so far this season. I mean, they're 4-0 and just beat around Wisconsin, a Wisconsin team that just looks god-awful right now.
Quit watch.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at Iowa, and then they're at Oregon, at Maryland, and then at Penn State. So they're going to earn it if they get back there, first of all. And I think, you know, there's an art and a skill – to being a good bully. And Indiana is a very, very good bully. But we saw them get, you know, overmatched by Ohio State in the playoff last year. Like, what is this team going to do, you know, as they step up in class here? Because I think that Illinois is a perfect example and a cautionary tale of why maybe returning production is overrated in the betting markets, in the rankings, all that kind of thing. This should not have been a top 10 Illini team. Yeah, they brought back a lot. That's great. They weren't like an elite team or anything like that last year. I'm not saying that they should have lost by 53 points, but like, I know we all harp on returning production and, you know, in the transfer portal era, maybe it means something, maybe it doesn't, but sure as hell didn't mean anything on Saturday. That's for sure.
Well, it's funny because three straight weeks, the betting market went against Illinois, against them when they played Duke. They win that game 45-19. Duke turns the ball over five times, just putrid in the red zone, a very agonizing L for a lot of us bettors. The following week, I thought was just a tricky spot for Western Michigan. Betting market goes against them, just I think more situationally. They take care of business, win 38-0. And then this is kind of where the rubber met the road, where, you know, you talk to, you know, I know Humans and Paul Stone and a handful of other bettors, and I imagine yourself as well. The AP ranking just did not compare to what they were in power ratings. And it's not to say that Illinois is a bad football team. And I feel like people get so sensitive at times. It's like, whoa, you think we stink? No, no one's saying that you stink. You're just not the ninth best team in the country. And that was proven out this weekend against Indiana. And that's where I think the fascinating discussion comes in. It's like, all right, Indiana put it on them. Now, where is this Indiana team? Because there were some parallels a little bit to last year with Indiana and Illinois in this regard, where Indiana was just steamrolling the competition and flying up the rankings, and the betting market was having a hard time kind of trying to grab on when was the right time to maybe go against them. And ultimately, it was that Ohio State game in the middle of, or in November. So, you know, Adam, where do you have Indiana now? Because this is a team that it's not a fluke. And I think, you know, I didn't know what to expect from Indiana this year. I knew there wouldn't be a massive drop off. I liked what they did in the portal. Obviously, Fernando Mendoza, I think, is an upgrade over Rourke, who was a very good quarterback a year ago for Indiana. But Mendoza is just another level. He's an NFL legit prospect, maybe a first round pick. So I'm curious what you've done with your Indiana power rating and how high you now have this team.
Yeah, I have Indiana up to 12th in the nation now. I had Illinois, I think, 23rd going into last week. Now they're in the 30s for me. So to your point, I mean, I had them a good, you know, 14, 15 spots below what the rankings did. Look, I mean, again, this is something that's really, really tough for me. And I have a problem with this pretty much every single year in my power ratings, which is a team like Indiana, right? They go out there and they just blow out, you know, a bunch of teams early on. Did struggle a little bit with Old Dominion in week one. And by the way, Old Dominion, they look pretty good. Nice win for them over Virginia Tech. You know, so I have a problem with rating teams like this because you have to keep upgrading them. You have to keep giving them credit for what they're doing because you know that their lines are going to reflect that, whether they're inflated or, you know, that's a true assessment of where the team is. Then they play Illinois and they just completely humiliate them. And I think to some degree, they probably are a little bit overrated in the market right now. But it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, do you want to step in front of them? You know, is this the time that you really want to do it? I have Indiana a 3-point favorite this week against Iowa. So, I mean, obviously, I'm pretty far off of the market in that regard. Am I too low on Indiana? Am I too high on Iowa? This will be the week that I find out. And if I have to pay a price for doing so, you know, taking Iowa plus 7.5, something like that, then so be it. But I think right now the perception of Indiana is definitely pretty inflated out there. And look, Iowa's not great, again, offensively, but this is a very legit defense. And so I think points are at a premium. And I think that, you know, Indiana right now, especially seeing that total come down, I just think Indiana's a little bit overrated market-wide.
Yeah, and to your point, right, there was a tax being paid on Indiana a year ago in the market, and it didn't really matter until they played Ohio State and they played Notre Dame. And, you know, this kind of reminded me, I want to give credit where credit's due. I think it might have been the Bear who mentioned on his podcast, but this past weekend reminded me a little bit of that Indiana win a year ago over Nebraska, where they went in and just unleashed all sorts of hell on that Nebraska team and won by a million. But that kind of, you know, weaves this into overreaction or market correction. One of the biggest movers from last week to this week, Adam, is Indiana against Iowa. So what I've been doing is every Wednesday night, I grab all of the look ahead lines that DraftKings puts out there. I think FanDuel does it as well, but I just do it with DraftKings. And then I compare it to where the market is on either Sunday night or Monday morning. And I did it today, Monday morning. Adam, last week, the look-ahead line was Indiana -3, juiced at -15. Right now, it's Indiana minus 7.5. So you've seen a 4.5-point move. And I think part of it is validated because of the performance we saw from this Indiana team. But that's the thing that we try to figure out as bettors. Is this a market correction or is this an overreaction? A couple weeks ago, for example, we saw the Georgia Tech line against Clemson get steamed like crazy. And that was a market correction because Clemson was the dead wrong side in that particular game. I know you had a game-winning field goal, but something's obviously significantly wrong with that Clemson team. We'll dive into that here in just a little bit. But I think for me, Indiana and Illinois is kind of, or excuse me, Indiana, Iowa is kind of the fascinating one this week where you've seen a 4.5-point move through a key number of 7 against an Iowa team that, yes, Mark Gronowski, I think most Iowa fans has been a pretty big disappointment, but I don't know about you, Adam, and maybe it was the Rutgers defense is just that bad, but to me, it looked like Gronowski maybe starting to figure things out a little bit and figuring out who he is, because you did see him run the football a bunch against Rutgers, 13 carries, 55 yards, and 3 touchdowns. And it just feels like Iowa's going to want to grind this thing out and keep Indiana, who has some explosive athletes at the wide receiver position, just kind of off the field. So, yeah, I'm with you. I'm not probably. I already bet Iowa plus 7.5. And I know we've got a loyal listener who slid into my DMs and said, oh, everyone's a hater. I'm like, who's a hater? No one on this podcast has ever been hating, air quotes, on Indiana this year. But I think this is an overreaction a bit to what we saw on Saturday night.
Not this year. I was a hater last year and, you know, wound up being validated when they played Ohio State in November. Thanks for the correction on that. And then also Notre Dame in the playoff. Look, you know, for Iowa here, you know, again, like I said, my number is 3 on this game. So I'm in line with where the look ahead number was. And I did adjust Iowa up and I also adjusted Indiana up here, you know, for this week in my power ratings. But when you look at the advanced box score for game on paper of that Iowa and Rutgers game, I mean, they have Iowa's offense in the 83rd percentile in EPA per play from that game against Rutgers last week, 91st percentile in offensive success rate. Like, those are numbers that you don't typically see out of an Iowa offense. And I realize the yardage total wasn't impressive. They did get outgained. But also, I mean, they had 6.5 yards per play in that one. So it was just a case of they didn't really have the volume of plays that Rutgers was able to have. Rutgers ran 14 more plays than they did. So, you know, I think on the whole, Iowa was very successful offensively in that game. And we know the Iowa defense is going to find a way to play well. It's just what they do. It's just what they've always done under Kirk Ferentz. So, I think 7.5 is too high in this one. And look, if Cignetti makes me pay for it again, so be it. But you know what? I'll probably bet against them with Oregon, especially if they win this game. I'll bet against them with Oregon the week after the bye. And I really think that Maryland spot is very, very tricky for them later on in the season here. And look, I mean, no, nothing against them, right? Mendoza's been good for them. Cignetti's obviously been fantastic. There's so much excitement around this Hoosiers football program now, which is great because they've just been a basketball school for so long. But, you know, you still have to separate kind of the praise for Indiana from also the fact that I think the market's just too high on them at this point in time.
They're not going anywhere with Cignetti, man. It's impressive what he's continued to do. And yeah, this schedule is obviously much more challenging than it was a year ago. And this will be one of the first big challenges. And look, they aced their test. I mean, that's an A+ across the board, the win over Illinois and the way that they did it, exposing, I think, Illinois as, you know, a fraudulent preseason top 10 team. But I don't want to take that and say Indiana beat a fraud. No, Indiana was a dominant performance. The betting market bet them up to 6.5, 7, and the betting market was spot on there. I want to get to another team that you upgraded. So you upgraded Indiana 2.5 points. Texas Tech, a team that I didn't really know what to do with, Adam, heading into Saturday's game. I did not bet the game. However, I did have a position on Utah to win the conference, which doesn't look as good as it did heading into that one. Texas Tech had faced the easiest schedule in college football heading into their game on Saturday against Utah. And I know they lost Baron Morton. That was a big loss. Maybe it wasn't, because Will Hammond looked absolutely the part. He was very impressive stepping in as the backup there. And this Texas Tech team, boy, That was an impressive performance. Disappointing, in my opinion, from Devin Dampier. I really thought we would get more from him. He really struggled through a couple of interceptions. So what did you do at Texas Tech? Because this was one of the games, Adam, where I looked at and I said, neither one of these teams really had been tested going in, and Texas Tech aced their test there in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, and really difficult, I think, to kind of figure out what Texas Tech was going to be for this season because, you know, Zach Kittley was their offensive coordinator. He's now the head coach at Florida Atlantic. Tim DeReuter was the defensive coordinator, and, you know, he wound up moving on. So you had two first-year coordinators here, and Joey McGuire wasn't really brought in to be an X's and O's guy as the head coach. He's just an elite recruiter, and specifically in the state of Texas. And so that was the route that Texas Tech went. I mean, obviously, he was a little bit cheaper than some of the other candidates that were out there just because he wasn't as accomplished as a head coach. But they brought him in to seal the deal in getting kids to go to Lubbock. And this is a program that has crushed it in the transfer portal the last couple of years, done very well, particularly, you know, in terms of their standing in the Big 12 with getting, you know, freshman classes. We saw it all come together for them in that game in Salt Lake City. And this was a team that I thought last year actually had a chance to win the Big 12, just expecting the Big 12 to be very wide open, much like it appears to be for this season. Maybe I was a year ahead of schedule, but this team's got guys that can play all over the field. And you saw that where they were able to play physical against Utah, who wants to play physical. That's been one of their biggest assets, both in the Pac-12 and also in the Big 12. And they were able to force Dampier into being a passer. And Dampier is a guy that, honestly, I thought he was a little bit overrated coming to Utah because, yeah, he's a great runner, but he had as many touchdowns as he had interceptions last year. Obviously, a different team there at New Mexico, but he's not exactly a polished passer. And that's what it was going to be. It was going to be a matter of who is going to make Utah have to throw the football because they're probably going to win that game. And that was the case for Texas Tech here. I think you're in a fascinating spot with Utah this week, too, because now they go on the road to Morgantown, brutal travel spot. It's always hard to get up there into the Appalachian Mountains. 3:30 Eastern time kick here. A pissed off Utah team that wants to get back on track. A West Virginia team that's been as Jekyll and Hyde as anybody in the country so far this season. That's one of the more intriguing spots. I'm sure you're going to talk about that a little bit later on when we talk situational spots. But I'm curious to see how Utah responds. I'm curious to see how Dampier responds and what they do differently on offense and defense in that game to kind of get themselves back on track in conference play. But yeah, I mean, for Texas Tech, this was what they were built to do, and it just took time to do it with all this infusion of talent under McGuire's watch.
Yeah, I'm mad that I didn't give out Kansas as a best bet on the podcast because I know the market got pretty high, but situationally, it was just a primo spot for KU last week. You're off a bye. You lost your rivalry game, so you're mad. You're stewing. And West Virginia, they win in overtime against their arch rival. You've got a coach, you know, crying on the sidelines. You knew that was going to be a massive letdown spot, and it was. And Kansas went out and destroyed West Virginia in that spot. A couple other teams, and what I love about your column is you go into the weeds and you not only obviously upgrade the big teams, but you're going to do every team in FBS football. Two teams I wanted to hit on. One was a best bet for me and Matt last week, and it's always nice to get a 14-point home dog to win outright 34-0. So you got San Diego State, which you mentioned Jekyll and Hyde. You lose to Washington State, and you look awful doing so. Then you have a bye week, and you come back and you beat, you know, the hot team out in the West Coast in Cal 34-0. You force three turnovers. You look, our guy, Jaron Chiave Sangapulateli, look like a true freshman, which is what he is. And then you've got this Rice team, which I've been kind of begging lower level P4 teams over the past couple of years to just do what Army and Navy did and say, hey, we're going to get a triple option. It's not going to be pretty, but we're going to win some football games. And Rice did that with Davidson's old coach and Scott Abel. So two teams kind of off the radar. Also, if you want to throw Tulsa in there, a nice hire for them. They win at Oklahoma State for the first time since 1951. So I know three kind of off the radar teams that you upgraded: Rice, San Diego State, and Tulsa.
Yeah. So let's start with San Diego State first, because this was one of my biggest overlays last week. This was the game I was pretty much farthest off the market on, and I was too high on Cal. You know, I liked Cal in this situation. I still don't think San Diego State's a very good team, but I mean, turnovers really did it for Cal in that game. They had 5 turnovers in total. They had 3 actual turnovers, 2 turnovers on downs. They had some of them deep in San Diego State territory. That could have been a very, very different football game. If things had gone a little bit better for Cal at the outset, they didn't, and it happens. And I think Cal's got a really intriguing game against Boston College this week, where I've already bet Cal in that game. But yeah, I mean, you know, this is something that we're going to have. You know, I think we talked about this last week. I think we talked about this last season, you know, around this time. Like, the elite teams are going to be elite, and the bad teams are going to be really bad. Like, that's just going to be how it is in college football. But everybody else in the middle, with all of the roster turnover, the coaching carousel, all these different things, you're going to have a high degree of volatility. You're going to have a very high variance environment. I think Cal just kind of fell victim to that, and I think San Diego State benefited from that, where they also played, you know, one of their better games of the season. So, I mean, I upgraded San Diego State 3.5 points. Part of it was because of the outright win as, you know, a double-digit dog. Part of it was also I was wrong on the game, right? That was just a market correction that I had to make. Now, as far as Rice goes, you know, I'm curious to see how this plays out going forward. Like, Charlotte's probably just not good, you know, and I think that's something that we really need to take into consideration here, where first-year head coach and Tim Albin, you know, he's always had physical, tough-running teams at Ohio. Charlotte doesn't have the personnel to do that right now, so not really a big surprise they're struggling offensively. But Rice, I mean, it's still, that's a good win, and obviously, you know, their offense is kind of taking hold. That said, I'm going to lay the 14.5 with Navy this week because A, they run the option better, and B, their defense sees it every single day in practice. And I don't think Rice's option is really all that polished. So even though it's a really big number there, I am going to take Navy minus the 14.5. And for Tulsa, I mean, Trey Lamb has definitely injected some life into that program, but holy shit, what is happening in Stillwater? Like, that, I have not seen a program fall so fast, so quickly, that was, you know, pretty consistently reliable.
Mike Gundy's squad, man, 19-12 loss on Friday night. And that's a team that I saw Todd Furman tweet out a gif of Biff from Back to the Future 2. And he said, the betting market is betting this as if they have the almanac. And they did. It went from 14.5 down to 9.5 last Friday night. And the betting market was right. Oklahoma State is not a very good football team. And that was a stunning result. But Oklahoma State, I mean, you lose 69-3 to Oregon earlier this year. Now you lose to Tulsa. Last year you go 3-9, 0-9 in the Big 12. We've got a lot of situations now where we've already seen 2 coaches be fired in Brent Key down at Virginia Tech and Deshaun Foster out at UCLA. Now you look at Wisconsin fans chanting Fire Fickle at Camp Randall on Saturday afternoon as they got embarrassed by Maryland. You've got Oklahoma State looking at Mike Gundy, who has been a legend in Stillwater, right? And, you know, has led that program to very high heights. But 9 straight Big 12 losses a year ago. Now they start the season the way that they have with an embarrassing performance against Oregon. You lose to Tulsa. And then you kind of look elsewhere at some other, you know, possibilities. Sunbelt Billy, that offense is putrid down in Florida. It seems like the end of the road is coming there. What does Arkansas do with Sam Pittman? I know they have a fascinating game this week against Notre Dame where the market has come in a little bit on Woo Pig Suey. But there's a lot of spots here where you look at, you know, potential quit watch moving forward. What about Clemson, man? Like, this is something. Like, really tough for my win total on Clemson under. We need the Blue Devils to go up to the Carrier Dome or whatever they call it these days and get a win this week. But Florida, Wisconsin, Arkansas, Oak State, Clemson, teams that I am just really curious, Adam, what they look like the rest of the year because their seasons are a waste now.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, you know, for Clemson to start 0-2 here in the ACC where you and I talked about this, right? It was very hard to see a path for Clemson to not make the ACC championship game, right? I mean, I'm surprised at how Florida State has dramatically turned around. Miami does look like a wagon. There's no doubt about that right now. But
that
like,
defense is, it's real and it's spectacular.
It really is. I mean, you know, now, like, you look at Clemson here, right? I mean, I made the mistake of betting on Bill Belichick and the Tar Heels against Central Florida. They look terrible. So you would think Clemson should get back on track here. Boston College, I mean, I think Boston College is really, really bad. As I mentioned, I already played Cal this week. I think Boston College is terrible. SMU.
Stanford.
SMU, eh, doesn't look good. Duke, eh. Florida State, not looking great. Louisville. And then, I mean, who knows what South Carolina looks like by the end of the year. I mean, you talk about a team on quit watch, right? I mean, it makes so much sense. I don't know if he would leave Columbia, but obviously it makes so much sense for Shane Beamer to go to Virginia Tech and follow in his father's footsteps and be the head coach there with Brent Pry now fired. So, you know, where is South Carolina at the end of the year? I don't know, especially with how things have kind of gone here for them so far. But I mean, are we talking about Clemson not even making a bowl game? Because I think we are. I think there's a very realistic possibility that they don't. And honestly, based on the adjustments I've made with them, I'll look this up here. I mean, I still have them for 7.64 wins based on the rest of their schedule. But I mean, I think 7-5 is best case scenario.
I mean, I think the Florida one is pretty interesting. By the way, I said Brent Key. I always mix them up. Brent Key's very alive and well, thriving at Georgia Tech.
Yes.
As thank you to Temple, late touchdown there. Much appreciated there to get the backdoor cover. Brent Pry, as you correctly stated, is the one who got fired from Virginia Tech. Look, I just, you know, Sunbelt Billy saved his job last year. And look, two straight weeks, I bet on this Florida team 2 weeks ago. I'll swallow it. It's no big deal. They turned the ball over 5 times. Watching that game on Saturday night, it just felt like that defense tried their hardest, man. They busted their ass, but that offense is horrendous. And once again, Miami, to your point, and I agree, we stated it last week, they might be the best team in the country. It's very well possible. And this stretch upcoming where you've got Florida State bye week this week, Florida State bye week, then Louisville, I mean, all they have to do, Adam, is go 1-1 and they're locking up a playoff berth. The rest of their schedule is an absolute joke. And it's just the way it's scheduled out. And look, they beat Notre Dame, who we'll see what they end up being. But the offense looks legit in South Bend. The defense is a nightmare. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And then you've got a nice win over Florida. And you hammered a South Florida team that, who knows, could be the group of five representative in the college football playoff. So Miami's real. And it's just, once again, I know I keep saying it, it's just, can you trust Mario not to screw it up? But it feels like with the coaching staff and the players on that roster, it's kind of hard to envision it. But I don't know how this Florida team ends up with, what, 4 wins when you've got a bye week, then you've got Texas and Texas A&M. You still have Georgia on the schedule. Like, the defense is good, but man, I couldn't have been further off on DJ Lagway. And I imagine that he's still banged up, right? You heard about his shoulder being an issue, but that offense is awful, just downright awful.
Well, you know what? In the NIL era, where you can just throw a bag at whoever you want to, like, how can you be a premier university in college football and have a bad quarterback? Like, I truly don't.
Well, we thought DJ Lagway was going to be good. He was a 5-star recruit. He showed flashes last week. Look, we did that. Our first podcast of the offseason, we ranked our quarterbacks. And I think I have some validation on Arch Manning of where I had him ranked. I think I had him like 7 or 8. And I think someone said, oh, hot take there, huh? And I was like, I don't know. He hasn't played yet. But
shit, he's like 78 now.
Right. But I was dead wrong on Klubnik and DJ Lagway. So, yep. I mean, you know, it's been all over the place.
Yeah, but I mean, look, Malachi Nelson's the starting quarterback at UTEP now. Like, 5 stars don't always necessarily, you know, mean anything. And honestly, he's lucky to be a starting quarterback anywhere in college football right now. So, yeah, I mean, you know, again, in the era of the transfer portal, like, to me, it's just really, really hard to be an elite university, especially because you have to understand that, like, when you watch DJ Lagway play, you have to go, I don't know if this is the dude who can win us a national championship, because your bar when you're a Florida type team is making the playoff and having a shot to win the national championship. I don't care what your record's been here lately, but that's kind of the standard you set in the 2000s. And like, that's, you know, what your goal should be, is making the college football playoff. And I don't think DJ Lagway was ever really a guy that was going to get you there. By the way, one other coach, you know, we talked about some programs that already have vacancies or you know, may potentially have them going forward. So Dave Aranda almost got himself fired last year. They lose at home to Arizona State. They're not going to lose to Oklahoma State. If they do, Aranda will be fired like immediately following the game. Does he keep his job at Baylor? Because you've got Oklahoma State and Kansas State up next. You should be 4-2, right? Going into the game on the road at TCU. I think Cincinnati's pretty good. UCF seems pretty good. Utah's a solid team. Arizona's really not. I think Willie Fritz and Houston could very well beat Baylor in that final game. Like, if Baylor goes 6-6, does Dave Aranda keep his job?
I don't think so. Yeah, because you said it. He's been on the hot seat for a while. Sawyer Robertson is not going to be around next year. And he's, you know, he saved his butt against SMU in the performance there offensively. Yeah, it is kind of funny when you think about Dave Aranda, elite defensive mind, and his defense isn't very good. I mean, that's kind of the shocking thing about Baylor this year. Now, I know we're kind of bouncing all over the place, but I am curious. I remember when Lance Leipold, it was when Wisconsin came open, and I do a radio show every morning up in Milwaukee, and I said, you got to go get Lance Leipold. This is the guy. And then they got Luke Fickell, and I'm not going to lie. I said, wow, I didn't think he'd go there. That's a great hire by Wisconsin. Obviously, it has not fared well. He made a terrible offensive coordinator hire. It made no sense to go run the air raid. They've tried to right the wrong with Jeff Grimes. It's not going well. Luke Fickell's not going to be the head coach of Wisconsin next year. When you look at that schedule, you could not lose to Maryland, and they lost to Maryland in embarrassing fashion. If you're Wisconsin and Lance Leipold's there at Kansas and he's done an incredible job, but he's 61 years old, do you go get Lance Leipold? I would, because I know what he is. He's going to win. And I think that would be the smartest decision by Wisconsin. Wisconsin roots, won national championships with Whitewater, goes to Buffalo, gets them to high heights in the MAC. And then what he's done at Kansas is a bleeping miracle. Or do you try to get someone like Clark Lee, who also feels like is a miracle worker? And you've got the tricky part of Vanderbilt is his alma mater, but you know, what's the ceiling at Vanderbilt, right? Is it 7 wins? Is it 8 wins? So I'm curious about Wisconsin and who they go after and how intriguing that job is. You've got the Big Ten money, but are you always, Adam, going to be below the likes of Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan, Indiana right now, apparently? But I think Wisconsin's job, if/when it comes open, I think they should have some good options, and my number one choice would be Lance Leipold to make him say no.
You know, it's such a tough gig, right? Because, you know, historically you think about Wisconsin football, it's a lot of power running. It's just kind of, you know, winning a lot of these close, low scoring games, sort of, you know, a lot of brutality in the trenches. Does that really work in college football anymore? No, not really. You know, you look at the teams that are winning now, they're all spread offenses. They're all offenses that have a ton of athletic dudes. So, like, Wisconsin's going to have to completely change philosophically with that program. And I do appreciate, I think Luke Fickell understood that because he appointed Phil Longo as his offensive coordinator, thinking, okay, we're going to have to spread it out. We're going to have to throw the football. Maybe it's an air raid-ish type of offense, but we're going to have to throw the ball. We're going to have a quarterback who can throw the football. And Wisconsin hasn't had one of those for, you know, a while. I mean, I guess we'd probably go back to what, Russell Wilson? So,
Can't throw football anymore.
That's true. So I appreciate what Fickell tried to do there. And I think if you hire a defensive head coach like that, that's what you have to do. You have to go out there and get a spread type of coordinator on the offensive side. But I don't know what you do. And I don't know how attractive that job is when maybe USC has kind of righted the ship. Obviously, Oregon is a powerhouse. You know, Michigan is a powerhouse. Ohio State is a powerhouse.
Yeah, I left out Oregon.
Penn State. I mean, is Washington turning a corner once again? Because there's a lot of talent up there in the Pacific Northwest. And they sure as hell ain't going to go to Washington State with what's happening with them. And, you know, no conference affiliation. And then kind of going into the rebuilt Pac-12 and all these different types of things. I don't I don't know that Wisconsin's a very good job. So if you're Lance Leipold, right, outside of, you know, your ties to Wisconsin Whitewater, like, do you want that gig? I don't really think that you do. So
I thought they would go after him hard when they got Luke Fickell. And right. Once again, I said, hey, Luke Fickell, if you can get him, you go get him. And they did. So it'll be that'll be one of the more interesting spots. Obviously, Florida, when that comes open, will it be Lane Kiffin? There's going to be a lot of
John Summerall.
I mean, could he go to Arkansas? It doesn't seem like things are going to go great there. But
speaking of Arkansas, you know, there were so many bad beats this past weekend. But good Lord, did they give one away. I mean, I loved them as a 7-point favorite. I had it 10 in my power ratings. Like, everything was going according to plan. I don't think that Memphis is really that good of a team. Anytime you bring in a transfer quarterback from Nevada, I'm not really a huge fan. I mean, my God, it felt like they had that game in hand at 28-10. And they scored 3 points in the second half. Like, I don't know how you don't fire Pittman immediately after that.
And now you've got the biggest game. Look, I circled that game as a massive sandwich spot off of Ole Miss, Notre Dame on deck. And to your point, I kind of got scared as the week went on because I was impressed by what I had seen from Talen Green. I, you know, knew this defense was leaky, but thought it would be a tricky spot regardless. And you're trying to salt the game away and you get the ball punched out from you and then you kick a game-winning field goal. Yeah, just inexcusable. And, you know, look, Sam Pittman – knowing my luck, Arkansas will probably beat Notre Dame this weekend because Notre Dame's defense can't stop a cold. So, we'll dive into that. I do want to take a quick break because I want to play a little overreaction or market correction. Just a reminder, you know, a number of people have asked me about the hat that I wear a lot here on the podcast. It is courtesy of our friends Rainbow Authentics, the official source of game-used apparel, autographs, and trading cards for Hawaii student-athlete. Every item tells a story, whether it's a game-worn jersey, signed ball, or unique collectibles. You're capturing the moment and owning a piece of Hawaii sports history. Beyond memorabilia, Rainbow Authentics is committed to supporting the community. Their mission is rooted in empowering student-athletes and coaches, strengthening local programs, and giving back to Hawaii with pride. With exclusive custom gear, Rainbow Authentics also makes sure you look your best every game day. So find out their unique items over at rainbowauthentics.com and help out Hawaii Athletics in the process. Mahalo to our friends Rainbow Authentics, proud sponsor of the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. I know it wasn't the result that our guy Timmy Chang was looking for, but they did get the cover. He is now 17-6, Adam, since taking over as the head coach of Hawaii or 17-6 ATS, I should say, there on the islands. Now, going to the mainland has been a tricky part, and we'll dive into that as a situational angle on the other side. But quick break, it is the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast. All right, Adam, we're back. And before we dive into a little bit more, you've got your column up at VSiN.com. Give us the latest and greatest offer we've got for VSiN and VSiN.com.
Yeah, right now we're running 40% off of the football special that we have. So, you know, obviously we're about a quarter of the way into the college football season, a third of the way, I guess, actually, for most of these teams here. But, the NFL's still rolling right along. NHL team preview is going up this week at VSiN.com as well. Our virtual NHL guide from Jonathan Davis. NBA betting guide comes out October 7th. College basketball betting guide October 23rd. I got to be honest, Tim, I love college basketball. It's actually kind of become one of my better sports over the last few years. I do not look forward to that guide. There are so many teams in college football or college basketball. It's just an unbelievable undertaking. But 40% off the football special will get you all of that and a whole hell of a lot more because it takes you up through the Super Bowl. So VSiN.com/subscribe to check that out. And again, looking forward to those NHL team previews from Jonathan Davis, who does a phenomenal job promoting his work at VSiN.com. Has a lot of action for people that like to bet on the NHL. A lot of shots on goal props, hits props, blocked shots props to go along with sides, totals, puck lines, all those kinds of things. So excited about everything we have coming over at VSiN.com, that's for sure.
All right, let's take a look at a couple of these market corrections or overreactions. We hit on one of them already, Indiana and Iowa. Another big move is USC at Illinois. So USC, for those of you who are up late, watched USC take care of business. Matt Newman's best bet for him was over USC Michigan State. That hit. So we've seen Illinois lose, USC continue to win, and now this number jumps from USC minus 1.5, which was the look ahead, to now USC minus 6.5 right now. And actually, as I sit here, 7 and 7.5. So we've seen about a 6-point move, Adam, on USC at Illinois. This is a noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific time start. Is this an overreaction or a market correction to USC Illinois?
So I upgraded USC 2 points. I downgraded Illinois 3.5 points. So that's a 5.5 point move. And my number is 6.5. So I think this is a market correction. I think this is exactly, you know, where these two teams should be pretty much. I gotta say, I've been impressed with Jaden Maiava so far at USC. I mean, his biggest issue at UNLV was, you know, just way too many turnover worthy plays, just putting the ball at risk, not really valuing his possessions. Seems like Lincoln Riley's kind of gotten a lot of that out of him already. I mean, 9 touchdowns, 0 interceptions, only a couple of sacks. That's not to say that USC has played a difficult schedule to this point, because obviously they haven't, but it's a really encouraging sign with Maiava going forward. And if he takes care of the football, USC's got some more talent, I think, this year than they've had in previous seasons. They get a bye before, you know, hosting Michigan. Pretty interesting big 3-game stretch here coming up for USC, but as far as this line goes, I think this market correction is absolutely correct.
Yeah, and we've seen it, as I mentioned, go up to 7, 7.5. I can't get on. Look, I'll take some ugly dogs. Just look at my betting card a week ago, and heck, I'll look at my betting card this week. There's going to be some ugly dogs on there. I can't get there with Illinois this week. All right, let's get to a couple other games that we've seen big moves. I always tweet this out. You can follow me at one Tim Murray. Let's get to Ohio State and Washington. This was look ahead at 11.5, and this now is sitting at 8.5 in favor of the Buckeyes. So still a favorite here, but we've seen a move about 3 points through the key of 10. Ohio State at Washington. This will be a 3:30 Eastern, 12:30 local kick. We know that Washington's always a challenging place to play. I took a little nibble when it was double digits. I do really like this Washington team. Damon Williams is a baller, but they have not faced a defense like they're going to face in Ohio State on Saturday afternoon.
Well, what's always interesting to me about games like this is, you know, I'm always curious to see what the market does when a team plays and looks impressive or has a really impressive final score and the other team didn't play, you know, because we all fall victim to the moment, right? We all remember what we most recently saw. Well, people don't remember what they most recently saw from Ohio State. The only thing that they remember from Ohio State is them beating Texas 14-7 and really struggling on offense, but the defense looking simply elite. So, you know, no one really paid attention to what Ohio State did in their game against Ohio, or, you know, what they've kind of done here in terms of Julian Sayin's progression through practices or anything like that. But what we have seen from Washington is that they've scored 129 points in their last 3 games. And for the season as a whole, they've scored, what is that, 167? So it makes sense, right, that the market would kind of be like, okay, you know, Washington's got an offense. Damon Williams is a dude. Like, I can't think of anything Ohio State's done lately. So I can totally see, you know, why this one has kind of moved the way that it has. I personally have Ohio State a 12-point favorite. So I think this line is a little bit cheap right now on the Buckeyes, but it is going to be Julian Sayin's first start in a, you know, rough atmosphere, rough environment, long travel. And I think something else that's worth mentioning here, you know, just kind of in general, I don't know what other games you were going to go to, but, you know, we've seen a kind of an adjustment in the Cal and Boston College game. You know, we saw an adjustment to USC and Michigan State last week. Last year, we saw teams going west to east and east to west in the Big Ten and the ACC really, really struggle with the long travel, not play well when they got to their destination. I think that's also kind of a, you know, weekly factor with these games. And I think that's part of it here with Ohio State too.
You know, we saw a little bit, we saw a flip of favorites, no key numbers here, but the look ahead for LSU was minus 1.5. And now they're a 2.5-point dog at Ole Miss. And Brian Kelly historically has really thrived in the favorite role and not thrived necessarily in the underdog role, even though year one at LSU, they got that win over Alabama. if I'm Ole Miss and I haven't seen anything come out yet, you got to keep riding with Trinidad Chambliss, right? This dude is legit. And, you know, a D2 national champion, the story's great, but he's better than Austin Simmons, especially if Austin Simmons is still dealing with that ankle injury. So is this a market correction or overreaction to LSU flipping from favorite to dog at Oxford this upcoming weekend?
No, I think this one makes a lot of sense here. You know, and I like what you said about Chambliss too and the way that he's played. Now, in fairness, I still have LSU a 1-point favorite in my power ratings. That's where I have this number. But this is also one where, is this like kind of the Illinois theory where like we just sort of overcompensated for the returning production, and specifically in this case, you know, Garrett Nussmeier being the guy who's returning, right? When you get
can I just jump in at it? I just want to, you know, it's sometimes, and it's not fair to do this, but we got to do what we do, right? How have the wins for LSU aged? Not particularly well, mm-hmm. right? They beat Clemson. Oh my God, what a win. Well, Clemson has completely fallen apart and is an utter disaster, probably the biggest disappointment in college football this year.
Yep.
And then they really struggled against Florida. They got the win because they were +5 in the turnover margin. Still a win. They got the cover. I don't know, man. It's one of those things where, to your point, and I think you're going into this about Garrett Nussmeier, it's like Brian Kelly threw a hissy fit after a game when someone asked him about his offense. Well, it's fair to ask. And now you've got to face a legit offense in Ole Miss. Their defense is really good, but is their offense going to be good enough on the road in Oxford to beat this Ole Miss team?
Right. I mean, we're talking about a guy in Garrett Nussmeier that had over 4,000 passing yards last year, right? Almost 4,100. They have 10.5 yards per catch so far this season. Like, they are not creating explosive plays in the passing game, which is what we all kind of expected them to do with Nussmeier being among the Heisman Trophy favorites. So, I mean, I agree with this one. And look, if LSU goes out there and wins and plays well on defense and shuts everybody up, cool. Good for them. But we know what Ole Miss is, right? Ole Miss wants to play the 41-35 types of games that they played against Arkansas. They're very comfortable in that type of environment. And if LSU doesn't have the offensive firepower to keep up with it, because, you know, Nussmeier is kind of struggling, at least relative to what we expect out of him, that's a problem. So I do think that this one has gone in the right direction. And I do think that despite my power ratings having LSU as a 1-point favorite, if I had to play this game, I'm taking Ole Miss, especially because, you know, again, as you mentioned with Trinidad Chambliss, right? Like, one game might be an outlier, right? You don't exactly know what you're going to get out of a replacement quarterback if you're a defensive coordinator. You don't know what the game plan's going to be. You're just not entirely sure of a lot of things. Well, turns out he's a dude. And so you have to respect that. You know, and I kind of thought about that. You mentioned the Hawaii and Air Force, you know, game that's coming up here this week. Liam Zarka, who's become the starting quarterback for Air Force, they were kind of going back and forth with him and Josh Johnson. Zarka threw for 246 yards last week against Boise State and ran for 110 more. Like, one game might be an outlier. One game might just kind of be one of those things that happens, right? When you start stacking performances together, you have to account for that. And there are some teams that have made quarterback changes that you have to account for. And I think Ole Miss is one of them.
All right, I want to get to one final game, a game that when it was scheduled immediately terrified me. And now seeing what Notre Dame is from a defensive standpoint makes me even more terrified. And also the fact that Memphis beat Arkansas, which I kind of expected to happen. Now you've got like this whole perfect storm unfolding. So I want to hit on a couple of things here. I've given love to the betting market so far on the show, right? They were all over this Tulsa game. They've been all over on a couple of other games so far this year. Adam, I can't for the life of me understand what influential bettor or betting syndicate bet Notre Dame and Purdue under. I don't understand it. Did they not watch the Texas A&M game? That number crashed at 51. That was over before you even blinked, because Notre Dame's defense stinks. But I'll tell you what, man, Notre Dame's offense is legit. CJ Carr, as Pete Sampson pointed out, had a 93.4 PFF grade against Purdue. That's the highest grade by a Notre Dame quarterback since PFF started rating the position in 2014. The problem is, Adam, they lost pros on defense. They lost an elite defensive coordinator and replaced him with, in my opinion, a bad defensive coordinator. And now their best defensive player, Leonard Moore, missed the Purdue game with an ankle injury, and we'll see if he's available. I tweeted it out, and I said, this number is going to get banged like none other on the over. And guess what we're seeing? 61.5 up to 64.5. It feels like stops are going to be at a minimum here in this particular game because I trust this Notre Dame offense, but I don't trust their defense. And I think Bobby Petrino is going to be able to scheme it up pretty well against the Irish on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, also, you know, you think back to the Texas A&M game where, you know, Marcel Reed, a guy who can move around, you know, he only had 7 carries for 37 yards, but he also had 360 passing yards on 17 completions. So,
and left yards on the field. I mean, he airmailed some wide open dudes.
Right. And I think it's also worth pointing out that, you know, not only that, and you get another mobile quarterback here in Talen Green, but also Notre Dame. I mean, they really got the running game going against Purdue. And I think that's a really good sign for them going forward with the way that Carr has played. You know, an efficient 10 for 12, 223 yards last week, but Jeremiah Love went off, buck 57. Jadarian Price over 8 yards a carry as well. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to see stops, you know, in this game. And I guess maybe that's something that does kind of disappoint me a little bit about Arkansas, I guess, is, you know, 28 points in the first half last week and then just 3 in the second half, where really wouldn't have expected that out of them. Honestly, I mean, not only looking at the total, but like, I know 5.5 on the road with a bad defense is daunting. Is Notre Dame the right side here too?
I don't know, man. I'm not going to touch it. That game.
I thought you like ugly bets.
I do.
Only when they're getting points. Is that what it is? You don't like an ugly favorite?
No, I mean, I guess Miami wasn't an ugly favorite when they were 17.5 against South Florida, but that was kind of telling you the side there. Well, speaking of which, let's get to some situational angles here this upcoming week. And an ugly dog that I think I'm going to have to bet is Florida Atlantic, catching 2 touchdowns at home. This is going to be a massive letdown spot for Memphis. And I want to see a little bit more from our guy, Zach Kittley, the youngest head coach, I should say, in college football. And look, I've backed some ugly dogs. It has not been pretty. They lost 2 weeks ago to Florida International. Florida Atlantic might just be a bad football team. Extra time to prepare for this game. Classic letdown spot, night game. I don't know if it's going to be an atmosphere whatsoever there, but
is there ever an atmosphere in Boca Raton?
I don't know. Probably not. Maybe we could get some of the folks from Del Boca Vista to come out and cheer them on. I don't know.
I mean, it's a 7 o'clock kickoff. Half the city's asleep by then.
That's true. Maybe it's better if they started this game at like 11 a.m. but I think the games that I eyed up for a potential letdown, I think Memphis is in a letdown spot, laying 14. Indiana, I don't know if it's a letdown spot or more of just a overreaction to what we saw. And then I'll point this one out. Hawaii, my beloved Bows, this is going to be a tricky one, right? This is their 6th straight game, Adam. They're coming back to the mainland. The Fresno State game was taxing. That is their arch rival. They lose that game. I'm not in love with Air Force. Air Force does play Navy the following week, which obviously is a massive one for the Falcons. I do wonder, kind of like what we saw with Kennesaw State against Arkansas State this past weekend. Arkansas State had played in back-to-back weeks, Arkansas and Iowa State. They went on the road to Kennesaw State and they lose as a 5.5-6 point favorite. I just think this might be a situation where the Bows could be out of gas and fall to the Air Force Falcons here.
Yeah, and by the way, that Kennesaw State-Arkansas State game, not nearly as close as the final score would suggest. Kennesaw State was far and away the better team in that game. I gave them a pretty big bump in my power ratings as a result. I can't argue with anything you said on those games. I mean, I think that everything you alluded to makes sense there. I think that there are, you know, a few games that are pretty interesting. Utah-West Virginia is one that obviously stands out from a travel standpoint. And like I said, I mean, you know, again, Air Force, they've been a hard team to gauge over the last several seasons, really. I mean, Troy Calhoun, you know, had that year, what, they went 2-10 and then they won like 10 games the next season or something like that, had a dramatic turnaround. They're just a hard team to figure out because they actually, unlike Army and Navy, they have to have a quarterback that can throw a little bit because they do run the triple option, but also they've historically thrown a little bit more than the other option teams. And maybe Zarka is that guy now. And now that maybe they've finally settled on a quarterback, maybe that's something that'll help. I mean, Western Michigan finally settled on a quarterback last week and they knocked off Toledo outright. So maybe some stability kind of helps a little bit there. And also for Alejandro, I mean, had the three interceptions in that game against Fresno State, you know, coming off the ankle, you know, not getting a whole lot of important reps in practice early in the season for a first time starter. You know, all of those things I think are definitely, you know, factors and things that you want to pay attention to in these games. So I completely agree with you about several of those. I want to bring a couple up to you here because I think that, you know, obviously we could talk about the marquee games. I mean, Oregon going all the way out to Penn State is definitely an interesting one here. I'm really curious to see what happens with TCU and Arizona State here this week. You know, TCU beats SMU, final iron skillet game. You know, Rhett Lashley's throwing barbs at TCU for not wanting to play the rivalry, all that kind of thing. But they won. They took care of business. Josh Hoover had 5 touchdown passes. They're on the road in Tempe here. Friday night game. Going to be, you talk about environments. Going to be a hell of an environment for this one.
No doubt.
With the Sun Devils at home, off of the road, outright win as a short dog against Baylor. What do you think about this one here? Because I'm really curious to see how this game plays out. Move on the under here so far. It's kind of really been the only story in terms of a line move. But that's a game that I think you could make a case for both teams being in tough spots.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually put TCU on my letdown list, but I have a hard time making it a letdown when you're facing the reigning conference champion, you know, on the road. They're going to be up for it. But it is, you know, a short week, as you alluded to. You've got a little bit of travel for TCU. I love these quarterbacks, man. Levitt versus Hoover. I love the Big 12. We talked about it a lot. The quarterback play this year in the Big 12, I think, is very good. And once again, I can't say enough about what we saw from the Texas Tech backup. I don't know what the severity of Morton is going to be. It looked like that was a concussion, but Hammond looked the part. I don't know what to do with that game. I think if I had to play it, I'd probably look at the home favorite, just laying the 2.5. But, you know, I'll say this, Adam, and I don't want this to be a cop-out, but doesn't that feel like a perfect live betting game when you've got a total of, you know, 55.5? Doesn't it feel like they're going to trade blows like a heavyweight fight? Like TCU scores, get Arizona plus points. Arizona State scores, maybe get TCU north of a touchdown. It just feels like one of those games that's going to ebb and flow.
Yeah, it really does. I completely agree with you. And the nice thing is, I mean, it's not in a standalone window because you do have Houston and Oregon State that'll kick off around halftime-ish of TCU and Arizona State. But yeah, it really does feel like that type of game where you're going to get some massive swings probably. I like Hoover. I like Robertson. I like Levitt. It's a very strong conference for quarterbacks, which is good to see because, I mean, that's kind of historically what the Big 12 has been. A couple other ones that I want to ask you about here. You want to talk about teams that it feels like have the potential to quit. I could never have imagined Old Dominion being a 16-point favorite over Liberty by week 5. There were some things I was right about coming into the season. My God, was I wrong about Liberty. Like, they bring in Ethan Vasco, the Coastal Carolina transfer, who Chadwell recruited to Conway to run his offense, gets him now to run said offense, and they look abominable. Like, is there any hope that this team steps up and, like, plays remotely close to what should be their standard?
You know, it's funny. I was listening to, I'll leave his name out, and I actually really like his opinion. He's a national analyst. I think he does the good job, but he was just kind of throwing names out there for the Virginia Tech job, and he threw out Jamie Chadwell. And I'm like, I know you're busy focusing on Power 4 football, as you should be. Jamie Chadwell ain't getting the Virginia Tech job. They are a nightmare right
Shit,
now.
Shit, Ricky Ronnie's got a better chance at it than Chadwell does.
I would agree. I mean, the guy who beat Jamie Chadwell has a very good chance. And Bob Chesney, if it isn't, as you mentioned, Shane Beamer, who I'm sure that's your first call, and you make him say no, we'll see if he ultimately decides what he wants to do. But yeah, I mean, certainly off the radar. Liberty last year, massive disappointment. This year,
it's somehow worse.
It's worse. I mean, they're 1-3, Adam. And, you know, yeah, it is. You looked at that schedule and you said, okay, maybe they lose to James Madison. They're 1-3. They lost to Bowling Green, Jacksonville State, and now they come off a loss to James Madison. So, yeah, that is, I mean, obviously you got the big boys, and Clemson's the number one disappointment, no doubt, in college football this year. But, man, Liberty, off the radar disappointment, no doubt.
I don't know if I'm allowed to drop F-bombs on this. I don't know where we're actually showing this or
whatever. Wyatt's listening. He'll bleep it out if he needs to.
That's true. They had 75 passing yards last week against James Madison. They had 7 completions. They lost 31-13. They ran the ball 42 times against 21 pass attempts. Like, is Chadwell just cashing a paycheck? Like, what the hell is going on here with this football team? You know, cause this is one too. We talk about, you know, a team like Indiana being inflated, right? Probably. And then they'll probably go out there, win by 30, and I'll look like an idiot, but
probably,
like, does there ever come a point this season where you go, you know what? I'm going to bet on Liberty this week. Cause I sure as hell don't think so.
I don't think so. Well, we're getting a little ranty. I did want to point it out. I tweeted this out on Saturday night, and look, I'm not trying to say this play swung my bet. It was the wrong side, and I should have listened to my guy, Hans Olsen, who's the color analyst for BYU, who said this defense is real, and they were, and it was impressive to see. But I've never seen, I guess that's a little hyperbolic, I've seen a lot of dumb plays, especially Miami against Georgia Tech a couple years ago. But this was one of the dumbest plays I've ever seen. So, Adam, I'll paint the picture. East Carolina's down 6-3. There's 58 seconds to go in the first half. They receive a punt, they fumble said punt, and they jump on it at the 1 yard line. So they avoid catastrophic disaster. There's 58 seconds to go in the half. BYU has one timeout. So you would think you get under center, you go and sneak it forward once, they call timeout, you do it again, you go to the locker room. East Carolina, from their own end zone, ran a read option. The quarterback, Salter, who is an older quarterback, I think he's been playing for Salter, of course, out of Colorado. Hauser pulls the read, throws it, and BYU's corner baits him into it, picks it off into the end zone. I'm like, how? And I saw a couple people chimed in on the tweet and said, well, the coach said it was a read option. How do you give a quarterback an option? There should be no option. It's sneak it twice, let's get into the locker room 6-3, and somehow, some way, you have a catastrophic disaster. So sometimes you just scratch your head and you're like, how would you ever make that even an option in a game as BYU just walked in and looked? Like I said, I took East Carolina in that spot. I thought it would be tricky. It wasn't. BYU was the right side. They dominated that game. They held, East Carolina, I think, ended up getting some passing yardage later, but I don't know how you make that play call. It is mind-boggling, some of the play calls that you see.
Well, and it's also one of those things, too, where, like, this isn't the NFL, right? If you happen, let's say that you have a bunch of successful plays, right? And they have a pretty solid kicker. I mean, Nick Mazzie's a guy who's been, 78%, 70%, 85% on field goals in his collegiate career. But, like, what is the ceiling of that possession? Right? Like, maybe you get around midfield and you could try a college kicker from 55, 60. Like, what the hell are you hoping to accomplish there? You're right. Just take your 6-3, especially because BYU was getting the ball after half. Like, take your 6-3. Don't do anything stupid. Don't, even a safety is bad there. Just again, it's like there's 32 of these jobs in the NFL. There's 136 of these jobs in college football. And every single week, I'm not a smart guy. I don't design plays. I don't know the X's and O's of everything. But, like, you've got 168, Division I college football and NFL head coaching jobs out there. And, like, every week, there's something where you go, did he really just do that? It's maddening. Maddening. It's not enough to win betting this shit.
I want to take one final break, and we're going to get a little serious here on the closing part of the podcast. The betting world took a massive hit, and I mean a massive hit, over the weekend. Adam and I want to talk a little bit about our friend, all of our friend, Dave Sharapan, as we take a quick break. It is the VSIN College Football Betting Podcast. All right, we're back. And Adam, you and I, the beauty of talking sports is we get to talk sports. We don't talk politics. We don't get into other things. We focus on sports. It's an escape, right? And I felt like it was proper to spend some time talking about someone that, if you know sports gambling, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have made a wager or two. Dave Sharapan is a guy that you've either saw his tweets, maybe you met him. I mean, everybody knew Dave Sharapan. And I've got some stories I wanted to pass across. We won't go too long, but I mean, we lost a good one, man. And just stunning news to wake up to that on Sunday morning. His wife put out a tweet on his Twitter feed that was very emotional. He leaves behind three daughters, his wife, and all of us. I mean, we all at some point, Adam, interacted with Dave, and the outpouring on social media has been, I was going to say surprising, but it hasn't been surprising because Dave meant that much to so many. So, I'll cede the floor to you. I've got some thoughts as well, but, just, you know, your thoughts on the passing of our friend, Dave Sharapan, over the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it sells it very short to say that it's a big loss for the sports betting world, because it's a loss for the world. Even if you didn't know Dave Sharapan, you wish you knew more people like Dave Sharapan. I mean, just a remarkably positive outlook on life, you know, shaped by a lot of his own experiences. I mean, you know, certainly he had experienced all sides of it in the sports betting world, on one side of the counter, on the other side of the counter. Just his wit and wisdom as a content creator too. I mean, the tweet threads he would have, all of his show appearances, the shows that he hosted himself. But you know, I was really fortunate to kind of be around Dave in a different sort of way. I'm not saying we were super close or anything like that. Although every time you ran into Dave, you felt like you were close.
He was right? Close with everyone. I don't know how he knew everyone. He knew an anecdote about everyone. Everyone has a story about Dave. I mean, that's just who he was. I mean, you know, and I don't want to interrupt what your story you're going to tell, but that's like, to your point, was he my best friend? No, but every time you saw him, he knew something about you. He asked a question like that. That was just who he was. He was such a man. He's one of a kind. He really is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when you go back home, you know, and you run into your best friend from high school, and you just get back into the rhythm, like nothing's changed. Doesn't matter how long you guys have gone without talking, anything like that. That's what it was like with Dave. And, you know, as a guy who, you know, everybody wanted to talk to, everybody wanted to chat with, if you had never met him before, you wanted to meet him. He treated every interaction as if it was his most important interaction of the day, right? Like, if he did have to go, if he was in a hurry, just politely excuse himself and move on. You know, I started talking to Dave before I moved out to Vegas. It was, you know, November, COVID and all that was still going on and all of that. And, you know, I was kind of at a crossroads to some degree with the place that I previously worked at. So I would, you know, kind of pick his brain, you know, about Vegas, about, you know, especially as things started coming together with VSiN and all of that. He didn't have to take the time that he took with me. He didn't have to respond to my giant text messages with his own giant text message, but that's just who he was. And what he was to all of us paled in comparison to the husband and father that he was. I mean, look, you know, I don't have kids of my own. I'm not somebody who, you know, regularly asks people, you know, how their children are doing or anything like that. I always made it a point to ask Dave, not only because I knew how much his family and everybody meant to him, but because the way he would light up talking about his family, talking about his children's sports accomplishments, you know, specifically when it came to softball, like he was like a walking dose of dopamine where like you left your conversation with him and you felt better. Didn't matter what your day was like, just because of how infectious he was, but also the way that he appreciated and valued the people closest to him. And it kind of made you feel like, you know what? I need to do more of that same thing. And I will miss him. It's not like I saw him all the time or anything like that, but I will miss him, and the world will miss a person like him, because in such a divisive, polarized world nowadays, we need more Dave Sharapans out there, and there aren't a lot of them. And it's a damn shame that we lost one of the good ones here this week. And not only that, we lost him in a hurry. You know, I mean, I remember his story time from the book, his tweet thread about, you know, finding out that he has cancer, and he posted that in mid-June that he had found out a few weeks prior. And here we are, you know, middle of November, and he's gone already. Just the world is unfair, but at least we had the time with him that we did, and at least his family was able to share him with all of us. Just a phenomenal dude, man. And, you know, it's a damn shame that this happened to him.
Yeah, the last part is so true. And not that, you know, losing someone to cancer fast or slow is ever good. But I remember I was going through my text messages with him on Sunday, just thinking about, like, when did I talk to him about, you know, this diagnosis? And, you know, I just remember being very encouraging with him and hoping, all right, you're going to get your surgery. I think in July, you'll be back, you'll recover. He was tweeting out in late August. I'm like, okay, it seems like we're going to be in good shape here. And then just a tweet stopped. And that's where I got really nervous. And, you know, like you said, I was not best friends with Dave, but he made you feel like that. And I got a couple of stories. We won't go too deep into it, but I think the first one is the one that I want to hit on that you touched on, just the pride that he had in being a dad for his three girls. And not to say that he wasn't an amazing husband, but I just, every time I talk to him, you know, he sent me a picture last February, I think, of his girls. They go to college in New Jersey, and they're playing softball together. And he sent a picture of one of them cleaning off their windshield with snow. And, we talk so much about softball and all of that. And that's the things that I'll remember about Dave. But, you know, from a personal and professional standpoint, you know, I was doing a gambling show. I started the Daily Line in January of 2019, and he was an early guest. And I used to just get texts from him. And I knew that Dave wanted to get into the more of the, content sports betting than he did. You know, he was kind of run its time behind the counter. But he was putting on, you know, the Daily Line when it went to television and sports books in Vegas. And he was texting me about it. So we really built a relationship there. And to your point about just personal things about Dave, the first day I moved out here in September of 2020, Adam, you know, I was with a realtor and we were looking at houses, and Dave came to visit a house with me. Like he was like, all right, I'm out of work at 4:00. I'll be there. And he showed up the second, I think it was the second day. I think I got to town on like August 30th or 31st. And the next day I was out with the realtor, and he showed up to look at a house with me. I mean, that's just the guy he was, you know. And I think I went, you know, I was, I was in town without my family for about 6-7 weeks, and I had my dog, and I brought my dog, I think, to a couple softball practices that he was there. And Dave was just so special. And, you know, he had, I remember when you heard about the stroke that he had in 2020, and then he overcame that, Adam, like it never happened. Like, and that's why maybe I was just anticipating the same to happen with cancer. And when I saw the news, I was just, as we all were, so devastated to see it. But he was an amazing person. And I think the stories that so many people will be sharing of him, and I'm so intrigued to see, Adam, the different stories that are out there, because so many people had so many different interactions. I was looking back at pictures that I had with Dave of just like a different group of people. I'm like, he just knew everybody, you know, and he was always around town. And, you know, I think as time went on, one of the last tweets or texts I had with him, I was at the UC San Diego Big West Championship game. And I see Dave Sherapin there with his youngest daughter walking up, and he's wearing a Trevor Hoffman jersey. I'm like, I want to know how much money Dave spent on freaking jerseys, man. Because, and he was always, it was always matching, right? He always had the hat and the jersey, Adam. Like, he had everything. Like, I could only imagine what that closet looked like with all the damn jerseys that he would, because it wasn't just like he'd be wearing a Trevor Hoffman. He had the hat to match too. It was never like, you know, he's wearing a throwback Browns jersey. If he's wearing a throwback Browns jersey, he probably had a Browns hat too.
Yeah, which I appreciate as a guy who, you know, was from Pittsburgh and obviously had no reason to ever own anything Browns. And you know what? It wasn't like the cheap knockoffs either.
No.
Like it was a quality purchase for him. Man, you know, there are a couple times, you know, like obviously most of our interactions would be, you know, I'd see him in the book, I'd be down at Circa, you know, doing something for VSIN or filling in or whatever. But I went to a UNLV hockey game up at City National. Fun time. Those are good times. If anyone lives out here in Vegas and looking for something to do on a Friday or Saturday night, UNLV games are a lot of fun. But as it turns out, between the two rinks, there's a bar and restaurant up there. So my wife and I are at the UNLV game, and you know, I'm going back to the bar to get a couple of big drafts. And Dave's there with his family, his wife and all three girls. And you know, again, he's having dinner with his family, right? Like I'm like, hey Dave, you know, good to see you, man. And it's like a 10-minute conversation, you know, and I wind up, I'm halfway done with a beer by the time I'm done talking to him. I go get another one. I go back out and, you know, my wife's like, it took you so long. Like, you know, there's no line for beer or anything like that. And I was like, oh, you know, I ran into Dave, and that's what it was. You know, when you ran into Dave, it was, like I said, one of the highlights of your day, because regardless of what kind of mood you're in, like Dave was in a good mood. That's just how he kind of lived his life. But you know, just, it's, I told this story on Twitter, you know, Sunday morning I found out about his passing. And you know, like you said, every time you ran into Dave, like he had an anecdote or there was something that he knew about you that he would bring up or, you know, something like that. And he so desperately wanted to get back out on the ice and play hockey. It was, I don't think Dave Sharapan died with many regrets. One of the regrets was that he couldn't get back out on the ice and play hockey because he had the stroke, and obviously doctors were very much against it. And, you know, he would always say, well, you know, Jess won't let me go back out there. You know, Jess won't let me go back. I'm going to work on her, but Jess won't let me go back out there. And it was always great because I knew that he was never going to push Jess hard enough for him to go back out there on the ice. He just wasn't going to put it at risk, but he brought it up to me every time. And he was like, you know, man, we need to get out there. We need to get on a team. And I'm just like, yeah, Dave, you know, I'd love to, man. I'd love to play hockey with you. But I was coming home Saturday night with my wife. We were out. She was out for one of her friend's birthdays on the strip. We were coming home late. And my hockey bag is, you know, in the garage. And, you know, we're pulling in. And it's been over a year since I went out and skated. I actually went back and looked in our texts. I hadn't skated since August 14th of last year. And she said to me, she's like, you know, are you ever going to go out and play again? And, you know, I was just kind of thinking about it. And, you know, obviously I started thinking about Dave when she said that. And, you know, it's just, it's another example. I mean, I've had a few examples in my life of, you know, finding out how short life is, finding out that, you know, if you want to do it, you need to do it because you don't know if you can do it tomorrow kind of thing. But for her to mention that and then, you know, find out the news in the morning was... it was tough. It was a lot, but maybe it was one of those signs, you know, of like, hey man, if you want to do something, just do it. And that's how Dave was. And he learned it the hard way, but damn it, he lived that way. And it was very impressive to see.
Now we're going to miss him. And I know so many people are hurting today and we'll be hurting for a while. And our thoughts are with his family. He had an amazing family. He was so damn proud of his girls. He was a great husband, and we're going to miss him, man. The sports betting world, I think you said it best. Yes, the sports betting world is hurting, but the world is hurting because he was everybody's friend, and that's what I said on Twitter. Everybody was friends with Dave Sharapan, and the guy got shout-outs from Neil Everett on SportsCenter. I mean, that's who he was, man. That's the type of guy he was. He became friends with everybody. We're going to miss you, Dave, man, we took a hit, no doubt, over the weekend. But no easy way to end it on that. But we just wanted to share a little bit of stories on our friend, Dave Sharapan. And I imagine your friend as well. At some point, whether you followed him on Twitter, his very entertaining Twitter handle at Sportsbook Consig, or you met him at some point. Maybe he was your proxy. Maybe you watched his show. I don't know what it was, but I'm sure many of you had some interaction with Dave Sharapan, as we all did. And he was a special, special person, and he will sorely, sorely be missed. For Adam Burke, I'm Tim Murray. We'll have an episode later this week. This is the VSiN College Football Betting Podcast.